Matt Bingham was the prosecutor for Kimberly Cargill's case, and this guy is a machine. He was very well known for his cross-examination skills in the courtroom. He was also really good at connecting with the jury. But what really got me was his opening statement in this case. Look, he had the four things that you need for a conviction: a suspect, a victim, a pretty accurate timeline, and a motive. And I haven't really seen this before. The defense, Kimberly Cargill's attorney, she's the one on trial, they didn't have any opening statement. Matt just took it away, said everything that needed to be said, and they said no response. But I mean, as we get into this case, you'll definitely understand why. So after Matt's opening statement, he calls the first witness to the stand. And the very first question that he asks them is, do you remember Cherry Walker? But obviously, before we get to everything that happened in the courtroom that day, let me take you back. Let me explain what's going on. If you missed my storytelling about these cases, make sure you subscribe to the channel because I got a lot more coming. But just so you guys know, after doing dozens of cases over the past couple of years, what I find the most interesting are female killers. The motives go so deep, the history is so long, there tends to be a lot of manipulation, there tends to be just a lot of stuff all over the place. So I think a lot of the stories that we have coming up soon will be focused on female killers. If that's what you're interested in, that's what we're doing now. Don't forget, folks, the Bose True Crime Blankets are here. They're extremely limited quantity. We sell these out, we'll have some more later. Hey, don't watch true crime without your blankie. But let's dial it back to who we're talking about today, Kimberly Cargill. So Kimberly Cargill is a licensed vocational nurse that's working at a medical center over in Texas. It's a small town about 2 hours outside of Dallas that has like 8,000 people. She's having an incredibly difficult time after her second divorce. In just the span of a couple years, Kimberly had two husbands and two children, one with each of these husbands. I think it was all within like 4 years or so. That's a lot, okay? A whole relationship into a marriage, into having kids. And I mean, of course I'm assuming here, but it makes me think about growing up in a small town, how a lot of times as women, we're kind of sold the best we're gonna get is a happy relationship and being a mom. Thank God for the internet now, because there's just so much to dream for and so many lifestyles that we get to witness. But especially in the 90s, when you grow up in a small town, you are told, hey, your goal is to meet a guy that you really like, meet a guy that your family likes, and then if those boxes are checked off, have a baby. I mean, I was born in Southern Virginia and that was it. That was the limit. So I feel like for Kimberly to have these relationships in such quick succession and jump into having children, she was looking for love. She was looking for that true love that was sold to her. She was looking for protection and that happy life that everyone wants to attain in a small town. But after her second divorce, it hit her really hard. So in the late 90s, she starts dating this guy named Matt Robinson. And this time, Matt is just a boyfriend. I mean, maybe Kimberly decided to slow down a little bit. Maybe she didn't want to just jump right into having kids because she felt like, hey, I've already got two. Let's take a beat here. Or maybe she was a little bit scared because she told Matt that the reason her relationships didn't work out in the past was because her husbands were wildly abusive. They were not only violent men, but after the second divorce, the two of them had connected and began to conspire against her. They were harassing her, they were talking about her behind her back, and you know, in a small town, she worries that information about her that's not true is going to get out. She's a nurse. She's just like this quiet kind of lady, doesn't have a whole lot of friends and family close by. She doesn't really know how to stand up for herself. So when she's talking to her new boyfriend, Matt, she's like, you know, I'm scared. They're not making direct threats to me. But, you know, in the past with her having these abusive relationships, she's saying like, I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know how mad they're going to get. Like, I'm away from them, but I don't know. And Matt said, hey, look, girl, you're with me now. I'm gonna take care of you. I'm gonna take care of you. She was giving off real like broken bird energy. And they kind of settle into this relationship together. I mean, no marriage yet, but they get cozy. And Kimberly gets pregnant again. Maybe she felt safe enough to have another baby. Maybe she really felt like she had picked the right guy again. But this time, child number three is coming. And it's kind of just her and Matt, but there's one other person involved. It's an older woman named Barbara Chamberlain. It was actually Matt's step-grandma, but she was very close to him and pretty much raised him like her own, so she cared a lot about Matt. And Barbara did not like Kimberly. You know, Barbara's got big grandma energy, so she cares a lot about her stepson, but she also cares about this baby that's on the way. So she involves herself greatly in Kimberly's life. Kimberly doesn't really like this, and you know, understandably so. But something kind of weird happens with Barbara. I read this in the court documents later, so I'm gonna try to piece together what I read. They said that Barbara was out in the front yard and she noticed some wet photographs laying outside. Now, this is in the 90s when they used to print photos. You know, you go get your film printed out and that takes a lot of time, and those photos are sentimental because you usually only have one. Barbara said that for some reason these photos were just outside, strewn on the front lawn, and it had rained earlier, so they were wet. She goes out there and she starts picking up the photos, and these are like Kimberly's personal photos, and brings them back inside. This angers Kimberly. It angers her greatly. I don't know if it's because she didn't like Barbara taking care of the home when she felt like she wanted to do that, maybe because it was her personal property. I'm not sure, but Kimberly's response was very odd. Barbara said that Kimberly grabbed her by the arm and started to twist her arm, this elderly woman. And Kimberly wasn't just twisting the skin on Barbara's arm, she was twisting the arm as a whole, to the point that this elderly woman thought her arm was going to pop out of the socket. And Kimberly says to her, while she's assaulting her, "What's wrong with you? Don't you know that I'm pregnant?" I don't know where exactly that came from, but Barbara was not having it. She went and filed a police report. Kimberly does get charged with a misdemeanor assault, but she doesn't have to go to court for it. I think she just paid a fine and kind of moved on. Kimberly did not want to go to court again. She had been dealing with it for years in the custody battles, trying to get her kids away from her abusive husbands. I mean, family law courts are insane. It is gloves off, because people in relationships together in a marriage, they're not documenting information constantly. They just have to prove to the court by any means necessary, well, that person's the bad guy and I should have this. Going through the court proceedings was devastating. It actually took her first son away from her. Well, the courts took him away, but I mean, it was kind of by his own admission, because the kid didn't want to stay with Kimberly. He really wanted to stay with his dad, Michael West. That was the first husband. Michael West and Kimberly had a tumultuous marriage. He later said in court that, you know, it was kind of both of their faults, but he said that it was a regular occurrence that Kimberly would get upset over almost nothing. And she would throw knives, she would throw glass, she would throw large objects, seemingly with the intent to hurt. But, you know, maybe Kimberly is just getting emotional over what he's doing to her, and she's just throwing the nearest object possible. She's a sweet woman, right? That's what she said. Except there was also this one time that Kimberly drove her car through the garage because she was mad at her husband. Kimberly's first son would often show up to school with marks all over his body, especially during the height of the divorce. When they were going back and forth with custody at the time, Kimberly's son didn't want to stay at his mom's house, ever. He never wanted to go there. But then when he would go to her house for a few days and then go back to stay with his dad would notice that his son was extremely aggressive in the coming days. He would be very easily agitated, wanted his space, just wanted everyone to get away from him. This wasn't like his normal demeanor. It was only when he would come back from Kim's house. The courts were heavily involved in this custody battle. Eventually, her son did tell CPS that his mother was hitting him. She was attacking him to the point that if you were to walk up to him and touch his shoulder, he would get scared. He would be terrified. Some of the teachers did notice the marks on his body, but I mean, he also played sports. They weren't sure what it was from and they didn't really want to assume. But one of the teachers later testified that Kimberly had some very strange habits. One of which was, this is insane to me, when her son would get less than a 96 on a paper, he said 96 specifically, which, by the way, to me is still an A, Kimberly would ask the teacher to punish the child by giving him more homework. She would demand it. And the teacher was kind of confused by this at first and didn't really, you know, pay it any mind. But she would come back in these furies demanding that her son be punished with more homework. When eventually the teacher said, I'm not giving him more homework. You can get the fuck out of here with that. Like, that's weird. They recognized this strange behavior and they saw the marks, but they didn't correlate it all together. But the teachers did think that Kimberly Cargill was like low-key mad weird. One of the teachers, Mrs. Carter, she claimed that the first time she ever met Kimberly was at a teacher's night. And she showed up with her son and she goes to check in and realizes that her son has four teachers. And she gets furious. She was saying, I don't have time for this. This is too much. Why can't he just have one teacher? And everyone's like, yo, what the like, wouldn't you want your kid to have like the maximum care and not a teacher that's spread too thin? I mean, sure, like in first, second, third grade, they might have one or two teachers, but as they get older, they move through periods and go to multiple classes. Well, Kimberly was furious by this. I suspect it could have had something to do with Kimberly's tendency to intimidate and want to control situations. When you have multiple people that have a say and they can talk amongst themselves about your behavior, it's a lot more difficult to divide and conquer. She probably felt like she had less power because they would all be interconnected, but that's just my suspicion. Kimberly is furious that he has four teachers and she storms out. And so Ms. Carter's like, all right, good riddance, bitch. She sees her leave and thinks they're gone. About 90 minutes later, Kimberly comes back, but this time she's crying. She's crying hysterically. You know, Miss Carter doesn't really know this lady, but she says, oh my God, like what happened? What's wrong? And Kimberly says, like a child, I can't even imitate it. I almost did for a minute. I'm gonna just tell you what she said. She told her that the reason she was crying was because she was in line to meet one of the teachers and somebody had cut in front of her. That's why she was crying. To me, once again, this is all screaming almost narcissistic behavior. The perceived disrespect of somebody getting in front of her in line. And also, who knows if that even happened? You know, Kimberly's first husband said that she had a tendency to just make up situations that would find a way to paint her to always be the victim. Even if the victimization she was claiming was minimal or really stupid, it's because she had done so much wrong in the situation that she had to find a way to make herself the victim, but it wouldn't always make sense. Either way, people thought Kimberly was weird and her son didn't want to live with her. You know, speaking of the whole victim thing, during the court case, she showed up one day crying when she was trying to get custody of her son, saying that her mother had died just a few days prior. And so between that and this custody case, everything was really, really hard on her. Kimberly's mother was still alive. In fact, years later, when she came to the trial that we're talking about today, she testified against her. Ultimately, the thing that sealed the deal and took her first son away was that her child, when he was about 6 or 7 years old, he wrote a letter to the court. And I want to remind you, this is an innocent child that is probably no more than in third grade. He detailed a time where he was going off to school and his mother was angry again for no reason. In response to her own anger, she picked up a hairbrush and she smacked him across the head with it. And then she picked up her son by the body and then in turn by the neck and choked him out so hard, her fingernails digging into his skin, just pushing on his neck, a child, that the way that this little boy described this moment was, he said it was like an alligator biting on his neck. That makes me so sad because that sounds horrible. That sounds painful, but that was the only way that this child could describe that pain, an alligator biting on his neck. But it wasn't an alligator. It was his own mother digging her nails into his skin. He also told the courts that his mom would sometimes just lock him in his room. But as he, you know, got a little older, and by older, I mean six, he got smart and he found an extra key or made a key somehow so that when she would lock him in the room and leave, he was able to let himself out. He hated his mother, and rightfully so. Her ex-husband Michael later said in court that Kimberly had a habit of always doing something bad and then blaming her actions on something or someone else. He said that she was very smart, but she used her intellect to be manipulative and controlling. So Michael, James Bryan, Matt, and her soon-to-be third husband, Forrest, these men were not abusers. In fact, they were the opposite. They were mild-mannered men that were selected by Kimberly because they could be easily controlled with violence and intimidation, and they most likely were not going to speak up for themselves. Those are the types of people that abusers choose. There are some court records where Michael, the first husband, admits to like pushing or shoving Kimberly, but even though it's never okay, ever, to put your hands on your partner or any person in your life, there is such thing as reactive abuse. And reminder, this was the husband where Kimberly was throwing knives, glass, running into the garage with her vehicle. I mean, yeah, the marriage didn't work out. Ultimately, they ended it. But I don't think that these men were the textbook abusers that Kimberly was trying to paint them to be. By all accounts, she was the abuser. And every time she would enter a new relationship, she would pretend to be a broken bird, and it wasn't long before the mask would slip, just like it did with Barbara. I mean, all the guys had it bad. Kimberly would regularly call the police and claim that they were hurting her or abusing her. And the guy would come get yelled at, like her first husband. I think he actually did get arrested at one point, but he was let go. But her third partner, Matt was actually arrested, charged, and given 6 months of probation. But Matt said he never put his hands on her. But all of this information is available through the courts. I leave it to you to decide. Either way, Forrest Gardner, her new husband in 2005, had no idea any of this history. And Kimberly is very good at putting on a happy face in the beginning of a relationship. She's very good at it. And then once she has the baby, that's how she locks you in. He believed that Kimberly was a victim, and this band of abusive men were harassing, stalking her, and threatening to do the things that they did to her in the past marriage. And he really wanted to protect her. So once again, Kimberly rushes into love, and then she rushes into family. She has another baby. Forrest kind of starts to see a few red flags, but he chalks it up to this incredibly difficult life that Kimberly has led. Because that's what she said. That's what she said. She said her life had been really hard and everyone hurt her and everyone was big bad guy. That's what she told him. But Forrest kind of starts to wonder, like, man, you know, these guys are real bad, but where are your kids? And you know, I understand that the courts are all involved, but like, you don't want to see him? Like, I mean, they're still at this point, they're like minors. You don't care about seeing him. He never sees like sadness, missing her sons, anything like that. It's just, you know, she doesn't really have a lot of response. I guess the only thing she really mentions is that, you know, it's easier to just let her husbands have custody and do what they want because she doesn't want to get attacked again. Even though she sees one of her sons occasionally, her first son is nowhere to be seen. So you remember Kimberly's first son. Look, I don't even want to say his name because by the court documents, this guy hates her. He didn't even want to show up to the court case, but he just needed to put his mom away for what she did. He was terrified of her at this point, and years later, doesn't want to see her. But he has a stepmom, and her name is Sonia. And Sonia also has another daughter. And a few years earlier, this was in the late 90s, Kimberly says that she wants to see her son, the first son. And she shows up to the house with this almost raging entitlement. Sonia, the stepmom, was at the house earlier than usual. She took off of work because she didn't really know Kimberly personally, but she heard the stories, a few of them, because for the most part, they don't talk about her, and she just wanted to be there. Now, they trusted Kimberly enough to let her pick up Sonia's daughter to drop her off to her dad, and also to take Kimberly's son. But Sonia just wanted to be there to kind of make sure everything was okay. And so Kimberly comes to get her child and also to take Sonia's child to drop her off at her actual dad's house. And the little girl packs up her stuff and she's getting ready to go. And she's waving bye to her mom. And she's, oh, you know, I love you, mom. I love you. I'm going to miss you. Da, 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 da. And this just really pisses Kimberly off. Probably because she was jealous that, A, Sonia had married her ex-husband and they were happy now. And Sonia was a sweet lady. And B, because Sonia's kid actually liked her mother, actually cared about leaving, you know, giving her hugs, goodbye, kisses. And Kimberly feels like this is just taking too long. It pisses her off. So she ends up grabbing the child by the arm and picking her up and dragging her to the car. The little girl is screaming in pain. So her mother runs up to try to protect her, save her, because Kimberly, what the f***? And y'all are not going to believe this. This is what it said. This was in the incident report. Kimberly picked up the child, swung her into the car, the toddler, and then she turns around and pushes Sonia into a brick wall and kicks her in the stomach. She runs into the house and grabs her son, throws him in the car, and pulls off. There was multiple people that witnessed this, and obviously, they're gonna file a report. In the report, Sonia actually told the police, and I really love this. Sonia told the police that even though, you know, she could have fought back when Kimberly hit her and threw her into the wall, she didn't want to fight back because she didn't want to set that example for the children. So she just took it. She took it and she called for her to bring her children back, and Kimberly sped off. From what I read about Sonia, I really liked her a lot because not only did she make an effort to set a good example for the children, even in the face of violence, but she loved her stepson unconditionally. There's a lot of little boys that grow up with a Kimberly, a crappy mom, and they have a lot of resentment for women in the world. But luckily for this boy, he was raised by the worst type of mother. But then Sonia comes into his life, and she also has a very loving, well-raised daughter that's also a good female example. So now this boy who earlier, you couldn't even touch his shoulder without him getting upset or volatile. He now has this really awesome stepsister and this really awesome stepmom to be there for him, to support him, to show him, hey kid, not all women are horrible like your mom was to you. Like, we can love you unconditionally and we can heal you. And that is so selfless for a stepmom to do. So just a lot of the things I read about her, I really, really liked that. So, you know, in this world, be a Sonia. But that's an older story of something that happened in the late 90s. You know, back in 2005 with Forrest and Kimberly, he really started to smell the shit in the water. Is that a phrase? Smelling the shit in the water. Smelling the BS. He really starts to smell the BS, and he gets out of the relationship barely even a year in. Forrest is gone. So now Kimberly is alone. She has another baby. She's still taking care of her second child occasionally, and she's pissed. She lost another one. Look, narcissistic abusers, they love to have a victim. They love to have a punching bag, and they will do anything and everything to keep you around because they don't know how else to release their anger. So she's a single mom, and actually, I don't even want to call her a single mom. This I have a soft spot in my heart for single moms. I was raised by a single mom. This was a single demon. That's what she was. And don't forget, she was abusive to the husbands. She was physically abusive to her first child. She gets away with it for 10 years. So when people get away with bad behavior for years, what happens? That behavior escalates. We know from the court documents that the children were being abused. She was taking out her loneliness and her anger on them on a regular basis. But either way, Kim has to work. She gets a full-time job and she decides to hire a babysitter. She meets a lady named Cherry Walker through a friend named Marsha, but she introduces Kimberly to Cherry because Cherry lives in the same apartment building that Forrest moved into. Cherry Walker was a 29-year-old mentally disabled woman. She had a heart of gold. People said she was so, so sweet. But prosecutors said that she had the mental intellect of a 9-year-old child. Cherry could not read or write, and it limited her employment opportunities greatly. But she was able to live on her own because a lady named Paula Wheeler would come by every day. Every single day, they said for about 6 hours per day, and she would teach Cherry how to shop, cook, basically take care of herself. Paula really loved spending time with Cherry. She was the person that would take her around for all of her errands, like getting groceries, taking her to appointments, just anything. Look, you don't spend 7 days a week with somebody 6 hours a day unless you love them and you care about them. People said that Cherry had a heart of gold. She was the sweetest soul. She could do no wrong. And people just loved being there for her. Even at the trial, her dentist testified for her. Now, like I said, Cherry lived in the same apartment complex as Forrest, the one that he moved into. And Kimberly was a person that was ready and willing to take advantage of anyone. But on top of that, she didn't have a lot of money. Cherry only required about $20 or $30 to take care of the kids. And, you know, Cherry's mom later said that sometimes Kimberly wouldn't pay at all. Sometimes she would just pay half. But Cherry really, really, really loved the boys. Sometimes it was the boy from her second marriage as well as the newborn. Cherry loved them. And she wanted to take good care of them no matter what. Because Cherry knew that Kimberly wasn't taking care of the boys. They would often come to her house hungry. And even though Cherry herself didn't have much money, she did have like food stamps from the state. And she would often pull from her own funds to make food for the boys so that they wouldn't go hungry. Not under her care. The boys probably began to like Cherry more than their own mother. And understandably so. It's not like Cherry was competing with, you know, Kimberly for their love. But, you know, as demonstrated in the story earlier with Sonia, she cannot stand when people like someone else more than her. Look, Cherry was not trying to provoke Kimberly's crazy ass. She just didn't want the boys to go hungry. And she wasn't hitting them. She wasn't mean to them, unlike Kimberly. She wasn't locking them into rooms. So naturally, the boys liked her a little bit more. And Kimberly hates this. She feels threatened. Her crazy narcissistic ass just can't stand the thought of somebody else getting more attention or love than her, even though she knows damn well she doesn't deserve it. Kimberly doesn't even want her children. She doesn't care about the custody battles. She just cares about destroying and dominating her husband. And she does not have the tools to win these custody battles. She doesn't have the mental stability. She doesn't have the income. She doesn't have the passion or care for the children. So constantly they're taken away from her. And that starts to happen again when her second husband wants full custody of their child. So the court case is coming up with her second husband. And Kimberly's doing her thing. Lying, cheating, playing the victim, whatever. But at this point, it's been 15 years. It's kind of getting played out. I mean, the veil has been lifted and everybody knows who Kim is, except for her. She's the one that doesn't want to look into the mirror and accept the fact that she's the aggressor. She would rather live in this state of delusion that she's the victim and everyone is out to get her than realize she's the one causing all the problems. But she is fighting through this custody battle tooth and nail. And she's roughly able to intimidate and manipulate a lot of people around her. See, we all know that Kimberly's crazy. So when Kimberly gets on your back, it's just kind of easier to, you know, disappear and not get involved in her crap. She was fighting to win this. She was fighting. But then, you know, word gets around that the courts are probably gonna subpoena Cherry Walker. I mean, the court wants to know from the babysitter, have you ever seen marks on the children? Have you ever seen Kimberly become aggressive? Have you ever witnessed the children being afraid of Kimberly? Cherry doesn't really have the capacity to lie. When she's asked a question, she speaks from the heart. She has witnessed all of these things. So when you ask her, she's gonna say, yes, of course. She cares about the children. She was feeding them on her own dime. She was sacrificing her own food just so these boys could eat. She really cared about them. Not only did she really care about them, but she can't and she won't lie for Kimberly. I really want to emphasize that Kimberly was a highly manipulative person. And Cherry Walker, although she was 29 years old, she was so developmentally delayed that she answers questions like a child. She answers like a child. And I mean, not only like a child, but like a sweet, innocent child with a heart of gold. And when you combine that with caring about the boys, Kimberly knew that there was no way to intimidate her or manipulate her. She wouldn't be convincing on the stand, even if she did. But another thing that Cherry didn't really understand was she didn't know what a subpoena was. She didn't understand the court system. She didn't understand the severity of it. They just were going to ask her basic questions about the boys, and she could do that. But when it came to understanding this situation, she didn't understand it. Now, the people around kind of know that Cherry might get subpoenaed, but they're not talking to her about it. She has no idea what this thing is. So, on June 18th, 5 days before the custody trial is about to happen, Kimberly Cargill goes to work at about 7 a.m. At 10:18 in the morning, the subpoena is officially issued to Cherry Walker. She receives this, and she doesn't understand it. But it has Kimberly's name on it, so she figures she'll just call Kimberly and they'll get it figured out. She calls Kimberly at 10:20 a.m. for advice. Kimberly doesn't answer because she's at work. Cherry leaves her a voicemail. At 10:48 a.m., Kimberly Cargill checks the voicemail. Approximately 1 minute later, she calls her back immediately. She and Cherry talk for 8 minutes. They hang up the phone, and then Kimberly calls her again. During this time, I'm not sure if Paula and Cherry talked about what's going on. It's possible, but I do know that Kimberly kept telling her, hey, don't tell anybody about this. A few hours after being at work and speaking to her attorney, Kimberly calls Cherry again. She puts her mask on and she tells Cherry that she's scared. She asks Cherry if Cherry is scared too. And well, if Kim's scared, then maybe she should be scared too. And she says, yeah, I'm scared. And Kimberly says, you know, I think I can get us out of this. I think I can. How about this, Cherry? Let's hide. Let's hide somewhere on the day that they're trying to call both of us, and then we'll come out the next day and it'll all be over. She's taking advantage of the fact that Cherry doesn't know what a subpoena is or how severe all of this is. She says, okay, yeah, let's hide. Let's hide from them. I think that's a good idea. And Kimberly says, okay, I'm gonna pick you up later. At some point, Cherry speaks with Paula Wheeler, and Paula Wheeler says, don't trust Kimberly Cargill. You have to respond to the courts. You need to do this. This is very important. You cannot trust Kimberly. Don't do it. And, you know, Cherry tells her, but Kimberly's being nice. Kimberly normally doesn't talk to me, and Kimberly is certainly never nice. I like when she's nice. And right now, she's being nice. So I think I'm going to do what she says, and I'm going to hide with her. Paula is, I mean, in full protector mode. And she is telling her, do not go with that woman. Do not speak with her. Only speak with the courts. It's only a few days away. Call her back and tell her you can't go. You're not going. Well, Cherry listens to her, and she ends up calling Kimberly back. But Kimberly pulls out all the stops. And somehow she convinces her that she should come with her. I don't even know if she convinced her. I think she just clocked out of work and showed up at Cherry's house. The reports later said that around 7 or 8 o'clock, Kimberly's job was frantically calling her because she was a nurse and she left without telling anybody what she had done in the past few hours, what patients needed what, like where she had left off on things. She just kind of left in a flurry and went to go pick up Cherry. Kimberly is so frantic that on the way to her house, she gets a speeding ticket from the police department. Cherry calls her again at 8 o'clock and tells her not to come over. They hang up the phone. And then at 8:02, Kimberly calls again. That is the last time that Kimberly and Cherry Walker spoke on the phone. From 8:02 p.m. to 12:23 a.m., Kimberly Cargill doesn't make another call, answer another call, or send another text message. For hours, the calls are coming in from her job, trying to figure out where she left off, and she doesn't answer a single one. The phone records also show that on the next day, June 19th, Kimberly Cargill does not try to call Cherry Walker once. Because that night, Kimberly lured Cherry into her car, and she trusted her. And at some point during that car ride, Cherry Walker stopped breathing. And then Kimberly took her body out to the side of the road and lit it on fire with lighter fluid and left her burning outside
on the side of the road.
And when they found Cherry Walker's body, everybody knew that Kimberly did it. There was no doubt. In 15 years of her violent and narcissistic abusive tendencies, everyone was intimidated by her. They couldn't catch her in a lie. She would play victim by any means necessary. But right here in this moment, everybody knew that she had murdered Cherry Walker to keep her from testifying in this custody trial. The court was filled with heartbreaking testimonies. I mean, the prosecutor did not only a fantastic job of presenting the evidence, the timeline, the character of Kimberly by, you know, talking to all of her ex-husbands, even her son that wanted nothing to do with her. But he also did a beautiful job of painting a picture of who Cherry Walker was. The most innocent victim you could possibly find. And Kimberly murdered her in cold blood for her own benefit. Why? To cover up the things she had done. People cared so much about Cherry. Paula Wheeler testified for her. Her dentist testified for her. Her mother, Cherry Walker's mother, gave the most heartbreaking testimony. She sobbed and sat there and described the ways that Kimberly Cargill had taken advantage of her daughter over the years that they knew each other, finally saying all of the things in that courtroom that she couldn't explain to her daughter because her daughter didn't understand. Cherry Walker had no concept of how evil human beings could be, and Kimberly took complete advantage of that. You know, normally we talk about long prison sentences and what happens next, but don't forget, this is the state of Texas, and this is one of the most cold, callous murders I've ever heard of. Kimberly Diane Cargill was sentenced to death on June 7th, 2012.